Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
This is Danny, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. And recently, CJSF was able to attend an event held by Embark Sustainability, a student-centered nonprofit based out of Simon Fraser University that works to address systemic challenges within our climate and food systems. This event, titled Penning for Palestine, focused on bridging climate equity with social justice, specifically in regards to environmental degradation within Gaza due to Israeli military attacks. As stated by the organizers for this event, this was not only just a presentation, but also a way to bring together students, activists, and community members to write letters to urge university administrators to divest from war contractors that are contributing to the ongoing occupation of the Israeli military. During the event, there were two speakers that were there for the purpose of discussing the environmental effects of this current situation. First was Ali Soriano, a local climate organizer who also serves as the communications coordinator for another student-led organization, SFU 350. Here is some of what she had to say.
In service of settler colonialism and in the context of genocide in Palestine, how does that contribute to climate change? Well, an obvious one is the deployment of nuclear weapons, and the emissions that come from just dropping bombs is an obvious one, but I think a less obvious one is the fuel and the energy it takes to export and descend these weapons of destruction.
Next to speak during this event was Parsa Ali Rezai, a former intern at the International Court of Justice who is currently working at the Center for Comparative Muslim Studies as a research assistant, as well as a researcher for Law for Palestine and Spheres of Influence as a managing editor. During his portion of the presentation, Parsa spoke on the loss of plant life and trees that are indigenous to Gaza, as well as the current forests in the area that are inhospitable and invasive to the region. Here's some of what he had to say.
They've ripped out 800,000 olive trees indigenous to that land, and they planted trees that are very prone to forest fires. Does that sound familiar? That happens here. The biggest employers of tree planting here on this settler colony, logging industry, and they destroy old growth forests, which are very well managed when it comes to forest fires, and they plant a bunch of trees very close to each other that essentially create a very hostile and invasive habitat for a natural ecosystem that exists here. And when it comes to Palestine, they do the same. They plant pine trees in a place that, you know, is hospitable for olive trees. And when forest fires happen, these dense forests, they're not good at all. And they plant them where? On the destroyed, atop destroyed villages. And, you know, there's, again, another caveat I would like to explore here. Again, nothing new. Beyond Canada, down south in the U.S., one of the biggest movements towards conservationism and environmentalism was by Teddy Roosevelt, a guy that was very open about his genocidal orientation towards the indigenous peoples on Turtle Island.
Once again, this event ended by giving those who attended, students, activists, and community members, the opportunity to write letters to Simon Fraser University administrators to request that they divest from war contractors. Once again, this is Danny, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Thank you so much for tuning in, and this piece would not be possible without the support from the Local Journalism Initiative. This is Danny, your community radio journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. And on October 25th, 2024, we were able to sit down with Burnaby Councillor Allison Gu in studio and discuss with her a motion that she'd passed back in February for the city to look into the feasibility of a community investment model for the Burnaby District Energy Utility Project. During the interview, Burnaby Councillor Allison Gu goes over the ways in which this community funding model would provide more sustainable and climate-conscious investment opportunities for members of the community. Additionally, she highlights her hopes for the ways in which this project can spark change throughout the rest of Canada if this community funding model for the Burnaby District Energy Utility is able to go through. Please take a listen for all that she had to say. Hi everyone, this is Danny, your community radio journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, and today I'm joined here with Burnaby City Councillor Allison Gu, and we're here to talk about the possibility of introducing a community funding model for alternative energy systems within the city of Burnaby. The first thing I want to ask is, how are you doing today?
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Danny. I'm doing well, thanks.
Awesome, and I guess where I want to start with this is if you could just give a brief background on the motion that was passed back in February regarding exploring the feasibility of community financing for the Burnaby District Energy Utility.
Yeah, for sure. So just to give some folks just a base understanding of what the District Energy Utility is, the City of Burnaby is proposing to start up essentially a municipally owned utility company. And the purposes of this would be to establish district energy system throughout the city. District energy system is essentially a network of insulated pipes that transport hot water. And we use waste heat to be able to heat up that water. And so you'd be able to heat your building, get, you know, your hot water from your showers, your laundry, all through using this waste heat. And you wouldn't be burning gas, you wouldn't be burning fossil fuels, you wouldn't even need to use electricity to do that heating. And there's the potential for doing cooling too. So in the summers, having air conditioning without using electricity, you have a flat rate, you pay for your energy bill every month, it's predictable, it's not tied to whether there's a cold snap or really, you know, heat wave. Obviously that project is going to cost a couple hundred million dollars. And so the idea behind the motion was it's an opportunity for people to see themselves in as part of climate solutions and to be able to have a real stake in investing in, physically investing in these solutions that will bring low carbon energy to people and have the potential really to build in a foundation of, you know, energy democracy, transparency, real empowerment, and even frameworks of energy justice.
Wow, thank you very much for that response. I think that gives a really good picture for, I guess, what the motion was trying to accomplish. Have there been any developments on this since February?
Yeah, so actually just yesterday I went and met with a bunch of researchers who have been looking into how energy cooperatives around the country have worked and whether they've been successful and how the successful ones have moved forward. Interestingly enough, it's the city of Nelson has this something called a solar community garden. And the model that they had was they put up the land and they said to the community, if you're a Nelson resident, you can purchase a solar panel and all of the energy revenue that is generated from that solar panel becomes yours. And so you've got this garden of solar panels, all of them funded individually through community members. And, you know, people write them in their wills, like solar panel number 34, passing down through the generations.
Right.
And so the city takes on the operations and maintenance. But it's kind of these cooperative models, these community development models that have been quite rare here. But in places like Denmark, Copenhagen. I was just there recently. Copenhagen has a municipal utility that does offshore wind and district energy, and a huge part of it is that it's cooperatively owned by residents of Copenhagen.
See, that's so interesting. I feel like you don't see a lot of systems working like that here. So I think that was a big reason as to why I wanted to reach out for this interview specifically. Just because I think, yeah, the idea of not only people becoming more informed and aware of these finance models, but also becoming like having a specific stake in it, you know, mm-hmm. benefiting from it, not just due to the fact that it's climate conscious, but also financially as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing that you mentioned earlier is that how, you know, this model would offer a secure and ethical way of financial investment for the public.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that because right now you feel that there currently aren't very many options for people?
Yeah, there's not that many options. You know, if you were to invest with Vancity, there's a few options that are kind of like these global, ethical, environmental, sustainable portfolios, which, you know, it's hard to actually parse out what they define as ethical or environmentally conscious or sustainable. There's no real guidelines around what you need to do in order to be defined as such. There's funds like the Housing Accelerator Fund that Vancity does, where you invest money, you're guaranteed, you know, I think a 3.8% return or something like that, and the money goes towards building non-market housing, which is great. Like, that's really great. There isn't the same equivalent for local climate financing. So we've got, you know, people who care about affordable housing, they want to see local solutions tangibly actually implemented. There's no same parallel for climate. So even when we think about like carbon credits and carbon offsets, you know, if you take a plane and it's 300 kilograms of carbon, okay, I'm going to offset that. We don't know where that money goes. We can't see what benefit that actually brings. And that lack of transparency, I think, makes people feel less removed, more removed from the solutions and less implicated in the problems too, right? If you're not part of the solutions, you don't see yourselves necessarily as part of the problem either. There is no ethical consumption under capitalism.
Yeah.
But then there's no opportunities for you to be ethical, to be, you know, doing the right thing, and even if you want to. So I think this is really about, like, you can see your direct benefit in terms of carbon offsets. You can see directly that it's happening in your local community. And you have the ability to get empowered, right? Like, I think it's also, you know, when people invest money, they're like, well, I guess I should know what I'm putting my money into. So I guess I should research what a district energy system is and whether this makes sense as a financial investment, right? And so there's all of these opportunities for empowerment. And in there was this I think Nordic country, I think in Sweden, they're in an island. They're a municipality, but they're an island, and they went 100% renewable energy back in like 2020. And the way they said that they did that was they counteracted the NIMBYism. You know, you can build it, but not right here.
Not in my backyard.
Not in my backyard.
Yeah.
They counteracted that by saying to the people who had the projects in their backyard, hey, do you want to invest in this? Hey, do you want to make some money off this? And then all of a sudden, these projects that they were having so much trouble getting through started happening, and they got to 100% renewable energy.
That point that you made about sort of like the tangibility when it comes to housing initiatives versus energy initiatives that are climate conscious, do you think that just has to do with the fact that housing is a much more physically tangible thing versus, you know, climate change and climate solutions, which feel so, I guess, abstract to a lot of people?
Yeah, that's totally fair. I think that's part of it. I think what might be a bigger part of it is just the financialization and the how much money you actually need to be a player in the energy world. Like, yes, you need a lot of money to be a player in the housing world. But because there's federal government support, there's provincial government support, municipal government support, as a nonprofit, there are a number of nonprofits that do really good work of building out affordable housing, maintaining and operating affordable housing, you know, the YWCA, Catalyst, you know, More Than a Roof Society, all of these different nonprofits, you know, there's a lot. And I don't say that in that, we haven't hit the percentage of nonprofit housing that we need to in order to actually start to bring rents down. We need a lot more of that. But I think with the energy space, I don't know of any energy cooperatives in BC, right? There's two energy players really in BC. It's Fortis Gas and there's BC Hydro.
Yeah.
And part of that is because of how strictly regulated these energy utilities are by the BC Utilities Commission. And part of it is the amount of risk capital financing that's involved. You have to be a certain level of a player to make a real dent. And that's not to discount. There's, you know, smaller players like the City of New West actually has its own energy utility company that was established many decades ago. And so they continue to operate like an energy utility. There haven't been any modern utility energy companies coming up, and especially not so that are structured in a more of a community involvement way.
Later on in the interview, Burnaby City Councillor Allison Gu goes over the ways in which she hopes that this project is able to spark change throughout other municipalities in Canada that are hoping to also adopt this community financing model for alternative energy projects. Once again, thank you all so much for tuning in, and this piece would not be possible without the support from the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Bird Note. When a bird flies off and leaves only a feather, is that one clue enough to identify the species? The short answer is maybe. But first, note that unless you have special permission, collecting feathers is prohibited in the US to protect birds from poachers looking for ornamental feathers. Instead, you can take a photo. Set a common item like sunglasses next to the feather to give a sense of its size. Now, to try and ID the bird. Some species' feathers are distinctive, like the bright yellow shafts from a northern flicker in the eastern US. By uploading the photo to iNaturalist, an app and website that helps people identify wildlife, you'll get help from a hive mind of thousands of users. If enough people recognize the feather, you're on your way to an ID. Other resources can help too. A website called Featherbase has guides to over 1,700 species feathers. Photo references like this can get you closer to solving the mystery. Keep your prime suspect in mind when you're back where you found the feather, and you might get to see the bird itself. Feathers and all. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
My name is Mike Shepherd, and on behalf of everyone at CJSF, thank you to everyone who supported the station with a donation to CJSF's fund drive. You are truly radio's best friend.
Over 60 ancestral belongings have been returned to Shilkoteen territory in the central interior of British Columbia through a partnership between the Shilkoteen National Government and the Museum of Vancouver. A delegation of elders, youth, children, women's council members, and former Shilkoteen leaders traveled to Vancouver to collect the items and bring them home. Sharon Fortney, the senior curator of Indigenous collections at the Museum of Vancouver, says that this particular round of repatriation is the culmination of a long process.
Well, that grew out of a previous repatriation we did with one of six of the nations there. The other repatriation had been undertaken like 11 years previously, and it was actually ancestral remains to one specific community. At the time that work was done, they weren't ready to complete that repatriation. So we kept reaching out to them, and eventually they came to a place where they were ready to move forward. And while they were visiting us with elders and other knowledge holders from their community, we have like a big research table in our storage area, and the shelving directly behind it actually held several Shilkotin baskets. So community members were really like, they were looking at them, and they actually expressed to us that they didn't have any of those baskets back in their own community. Like maybe they'd been gifted four back by the government for some work they did, but generally they were absent from their communities.
Fortney explains that the repatriated items, including 29 coiled root baskets, 29 stone artifacts, a birch bark knife sheath embroidered with dyed porcupine quill, and one pair of snowshoes made from rawhide, sinew, and wood, are much more than simply objects or artifacts to the Shilkotin people.
There's a lot of knowledge wrapped up in sort of material belongings, and it's not, you know, we might look at it as just a functional object, but actually there's a lot of knowledge around how people use their land, where they went. When you're harvesting roots, you know, they might not be available everywhere. Some of the decorative materials, it might tell us something about climate change and resource management in those territories. It's also for the young people, it's a source of community pride. I think it's just really awakened a lot of questions in them about some of this missing knowledge that's in their community and how they're going to maybe go about bringing it back into practice, which I think is the, you know, part of healing and recovery. So it's really a beautiful thing.
The repatriation of artifacts is a key part of the Museum of Vancouver's mission and ongoing efforts towards reconciliation, representing a shift in philosophy for the Museum of Vancouver and other museums with collections of Indigenous artifacts.
The Museum of Vancouver is a nonprofit, and our role is to care for the City of Vancouver's collection. So the collection is close to 80,000 items, and about a third of them are Indigenous belongings, not just from our province, but from around the world. So we have collections from the South Pacific, Africa, South America, other parts of Canada and the U.S. So we have a collections policy that tells us our responsibility to the city for caring for their collection, and repatriation is part of that policy. We are still collecting, but we are the Museum of Vancouver. So in the past, the museum was started in the 1890s, and it was started by settlers who came from colonies all over the world. And that's why the collection is really diverse. And so you can't collect forever. You run out of space, you know. So it's really about what are the priorities of the Museum of Vancouver today. One of them is like redress and decolonization. So we are very open to repatriation requests from Indigenous communities, but we're also like reshaping the collection through our contemporary collecting. So most museums, they don't have very much money to do that work, but you know, we get a little bit each year, and we try now, if we're going to collect Indigenous made objects, we're looking at things that sort of are made by contemporary people, maybe artists, practicing artists that are made for sale or document some sort of an activity that they want to document. And so we're looking more towards host nation communities, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh, and also Indigenous artists whose stories connect them to Vancouver. So we like have, for example, a few hundred pieces in our Plains collection. But what does that tell us about life in Vancouver? It doesn't tell us anything, right? So we are very open to repatriation requests from, especially from communities outside of the city.
The Shilkotin National Government and the Museum of Vancouver will continue the partnership that led to the repatriation of over 60 items, with the development of a new collaborative exhibit at the Museum of Vancouver to showcase the repatriation as an example of successful collaboration surrounding the repatriation of ancestral belongings.
They wanted to continue their relationship with us, and one of the plans they have for their belongings that they've repatriated is to share them amongst the different communities, and also they want to encourage other museums, I think, to do repatriation. They also want their community members to be aware of what repatriation is, so they wanted to do an exhibition with us. So it'll be under the title, The Work of Repair. So one component of that exhibition will be just about the celebration of the Shilkotin repatriation. And they filmed and photographed the baskets. They're still discussing with their representatives what they want to see actually in the exhibition, but there will be probably a film about their repatriation journey with the Museum of Vancouver. And then these beautiful photographs of the baskets touching the ground where they were, you know, made and came from. Like, that was a really important thing they wanted to do with them. And then they're applying for funds to eventually travel that to little museums and in surrounding communities where it can be shared widely in the Shilcotin area.
Many of the items returned to Shilcotin custody can now be viewed at the Shilcotin National Government DAZICO office in Williams Lake. And celebrating Shilcotin repatriation will be part of an exhibition entitled The Work of Repair, Redress and Repatriation at MOV, which is scheduled to open in the spring of 2025 at the Museum of Vancouver. Jesse Wentzloff, CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, reporting. This piece is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and is made available for broadcast by media outlets across the country at frequencynews.ca.
Hot dog.